Will you humor me with a few more questions? I'm just so curious about you. You can look at each other, too, and you might be surprised. We'll see. Would you raise your hand if this is a place that you consider to be your home, your spiritual home, whether you'd use that S word or not? Okay. And how about if you're just checking this place out? You've visited a few times, maybe. Great, yeah, a handful. Excellent. It doesn't seem like they believe you. No. How about somewhere in between? If like you, anybody in that in between spot? Yeah, okay. How about if you've been here long enough, you consider yourself a leader here in any way? You get to decide for yourself now. You consider yourself a leader here. Great. I think that wasn't quite as many people as I would consider leaders already. That's all right. And what about you? You've been here so long, your kids, they were in the RE program and they've all grown up and moved on. Yeah, some of those folks. How about your kids have all grown up and they haven't moved on? That's how we do it. Did anybody grow up in this church yourself? Anybody? Yeah. And anybody in another Unitarian Universalist congregation? Lifelong you use or raised you use? Yeah. How about whether it's been that long or not, raise your hand if you're sitting in the same place that you sit every Sunday. If you're willing. Okay, good. And now, just because I'm curious, if you can remember back to grade 7 or 8 or 9, where would you have sat in the classroom? If you're in 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, if you were in the front of the room, could you raise your hand? How many front of the roomers we have? This is very important for preaching to you. Okay, thank you. And then back of the roomers? Yeah, okay. Good to know. Okay, and then if you were in 7th or 8th grade, raise your hand if you wore a seatbelt in the car at that time. Right? Well, did cars have seatbelts when you were in 7th or 8th grade? No? So, interesting, yeah. How about, did you learn the Dewey Decimal System on card catalogs? Raise your hand if you learned the Dewey Decimal System. Okay. Raise your hand if you just asked your neighbor, what is the Dewey Decimal System? I'm with you. All right, good. And how about if you visited your grandparents on a farm? Your grandparents lived on a farm and you visited them on a farm. Yeah. How about your parents? Parents were on a farm? Yeah. That's a huge change, huh? Came home from school for lunch. If you walked home or got home from school to have lunch, yeah. Okay, now last one. If you grew up learning how to type, if you learned how to type when you were growing up, good. And then if you learned, like I did in 6th grade, on a computer. Not many of us, eh? Okay. And then how about on an electric typewriter? Electric typewriter, yeah. Or a manual typewriter. Okay. We have a smattering across the board. Good. That's all I needed to know for now. Thanks. A reading. I want to share a reading with you. It's from the poem Hieroglyphic Staircase. Hieroglyphic Staircase by Drew Dellinger. It's 3:23 in the morning. And I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do? What did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing. As the mammals, reptiles, and birds were all dying, did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? What did you do once you knew? perform this poem when I was in the midst of my seminary training. I was hunting for meaning and hope amidst a world that seemed so bleak with chaos and catastrophe. And as I darted between my classes at Star King and the Occupy Oakland encampment and the UU Church of Berkeley in Kensington, where I was an intern minister, trying to figure out, you know, just the right story for all ages, bring spiritual sustenance to my community, I was darting back and forth, and the poet's question hit home for me. What did you do once you knew? What was I doing in this precarious moment in time, this moment ripe with both ruin and possibility? Ripe with both ruin and possibility. So I've been influenced by an idea from the social scientist Elise Golding. She says that to answer questions like that, to seek ethical participation in human community at this time, requires a shift in our perspective on time. She describes a 200-year present. But trying to think of that kind of time span in numbers, you know, so from 1918 to 2118, it doesn't actually do us much good. So instead, she says, imagine that the present moment spans from the time that the oldest person in your family, or maybe the oldest person you know, was born, until the youngest person in your life would die from old age. The oldest person in our family is Emily's grandmother, Edith. Only one of either of our grandparents who's still alive. She's 95. She lives in Rochester, New York, where we were able to visit her for the couple of years that we served out there. Edith's been living in nursing homes for a number of years. She's one of the sweetest, most gracious people who I've ever met. She regularly responds to whatever has just been said by exclaiming, "Well, my stars." And she calls her attendants earth angels. And she glows with the easy life of easy warmth of a life lived centered on love. And yet these past couple of years, she's also struggled with the question, why am I still here? With the body's aches and pains, with the difficulty to take care of even simple tasks, with a struggle to find any meaning and purpose in day-to-day life, why am I still here? The youngest person in our family, of course, is still Henry. Turned 3 in November. And a few months after Henry was born, we surprised Edith on her birthday with a visit from her newborn great-grandson. "Well, now I know why I'm still here," she told us. From the time that Edith was born until the time that Henry will pass on. And I imagine that as the present moment. What does history mean then? What does the future mean then? When I do, I'm almost overwhelmed by the pace of change. The pace of change in our 200-year present. Imagine Edith's parents giving birth to their children in the 20s. I don't think that they could have imagined their world that their daughter lives in now. I don't think they could have imagined it. I'm sure I can't fathom the world that Henry will grow old in. I heard they're planning to get driverless cars on the market by 2021. We'll see, but Henry would be 5. He might never learn how to drive. Really, he might not. And that's the stuff that I can imagine. The pace of change in this 200-year present surpasses anything that our species has ever known before. And at that same time that the pace of that change, the pace of life has rapidly increased, the time spans that we think in have shortened. Many human societies throughout history have had concepts for thinking about long stretches of time. In India, the Hindu idea of kalpas originated. 4,000 million year of human reckoning. 4,000 million years was a kalpa. or the Babylonians had a concept that was later adopted by the Greeks and then medieval Christendom. It's kind of where our heritage, the great year, 36,000-year cycle, after which history was thought to repeat itself. Or the Iroquois, the First Nations people whose land we lived on in Rochester, came to the idea that each decision should be made with the seven generations in mind. You're probably familiar with that. Seven generations to come. And while we talk occasionally about big time spans, 14 billion years since the beginning of the universe as we know it, 4.5 billion years of our planet's history, the culture as a whole seems to have a very different, difficult time making decisions beyond the next financial quarter. You might have heard a study came out a couple years ago that just in the past 15 years, between 2000 and 2012, average attention span dropped from 12 seconds to 8 seconds. And I love my mobile device as much as anyone. But, you know, Tony Robbins has some insight on this. You know who he is? He's a life coach, quite internationally popular self-help guy. He gets a little bit problematic sometimes, but there's a documentary about him. He said something that really struck me in the documentary. He said, people overestimate what they can accomplish in a day or a week. People overestimate what they can accomplish in a day or a week and underestimate what they can accomplish in 10 or 15 years. We overestimate what we can accomplish in a day or a week, underestimate what we can accomplish in 10 or 15 years, or maybe even in the 5 years that we plan to have in our ministry together. And I think that this frenetic pace of change, it reinforces that myopic focus on the short term. So we convince ourselves that we should always be doing more, always be cramming more into a day, a week, an hour, right? Just as we convince ourselves that real change, transformation of the things that we really care about, isn't possible. We should be doing more and more with each day, but we're hopeless about changing the things that really matter. And so this frenetic pace has tremendous impact on our lives, and because, of course, our bodies, including our minds, they haven't suddenly evolved much more quickly to keep up. No, while we continue to change and adapt, miraculously so, our human needs, our spiritual needs, they remain the same. I think our culture is just beginning to reflect on the cost to the human psyche, the human spirit, of the rapid pace of this change. The cost of all this modern convenience. Beyond our personal lives, our busyness, our overwhelm, the pace of change in this moment in history, it's also dramatically altered our understanding of world community. And in good ways, the reality of living globally interconnected lives has never been clearer. Right? And neither has that reality been ever more full with promise or with threat. I'm always mindful this time of year that marks the Jewish New Year, the beginning of the Jewish High Holy Days, this time of year that school starting. It's also the anniversary of September 11th, 2001. And though I think that the events that day have been overemphasized and exploited for political gain, that day does continue to signify something important about our 200-year present. When I woke up that morning to the news of the planes destroying the Twin Towers, I was getting ready for my first week of 10th grade. I remember the morning quite clearly. It's one of those flashbulb memory moments for us, right? And maybe especially for a generation just coming of age at that time, September 11th signified some critical ideas. I want to share two of them. One, the role of religion in the world. September 11th, sitting atop the headlines alongside the Catholic sex abuse scandal, which of course continues to unfold, the so-called religious right proudly asserting their homophobia, and the ugly, shameful fight against safe, legal abortion, September 11th becomes yet another symbol that religion is a source of violence and division and hatred in the world. Why aren't millennials going to church? Why would they, if this is what religion wants for the world? So the second is this, a critical symbol of the loss of our naive optimism. You know, especially for those folks who lived in a privileged bubble in the 90s, it seemed so full of promise and prosperity. After the stark evil of the World Wars, the final resolution of the Cold War, maybe, it seemed perhaps we were back on track for the long-envisioned dream of world community with, how do we say it in our principles, peace, justice, and equity for all. This has been a central hope of our religion long before those principles were ever written. Near the end of the 1800s, Unitarian minister James Freeman Clark, he penned the unabashedly optimistic 5 points of the New Theology, and it concluded with the belief in the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. It's a beautiful sentence. It's deeply embedded in our faith, in our way of seeing the world as modernists, as inheritors of the Enlightenment. But whether your symbol is 9/11 or the horrors of Nazi Germany or the atomic bomb or the climate crisis or the current occupant of the White House, it's clear that such a hopeful trajectory is not guaranteed. Belonging to this moment, belonging to this 200-year present means finding a way to stay faithful to our convictions in the face of grave uncertainty. And to belong as a religious, as a spiritual community in this moment means we will have to tell a different story about the purpose and effect of religion. Different story about what we're doing here on Sunday morning. And the good news is that's exactly what our tradition is all about. As in those beautiful words of the Unitarian minister Nancy Schaeffer, in our tradition we practice holding all truths ever wider. The promise of our religion for this time is a wholehearted embrace of pluralism, the community that sets aside arguing about beliefs to do the work of love and justice. This is a message our people and our planet need us to proclaim and celebrate and hold on to as if our lives depend on it. They might. And folks, our people and our planet need us to get better at sharing this message, get better at living this message, become ever more the community we have promised to be. The developmental tasks that you've named, the ministry that you've called me to partner with you on over the next 5 years, they are no simple tasks. They are not mechanical, technical fixes. These tasks, how to embrace collectively and wholeheartedly a clear and compelling sense of mission, how to make the ways that people connect and serve and plan and steward the resources of this community enlivening and enriching to newcomers and old-timers alike, how to wrestle with your understanding of the narrative, the story of this congregation so that our relationships with one another and with your minister and paid staff will flourish into the future. These are challenging tasks. They're deep rivers running over old stone tasks. They're Snake Alley Band tasks. With a whole lot of noise, a cacophony of beats, and occasionally a grace note you could never find in one of those snake-only bands. The times are calling us to change. The Unitarian Universalists of the 22nd century are relying on us. Our great-great-grandchildren are relying on us. We bless not only one another here with these waters and stones that we've gathered, but all of those who will someday enter this sanctuary of love and justice. So we've called ourselves to change. And I know for some of you, the changes in the order of service this morning, the change to the tradition of joys and sorrows that you did with Reverend Joy, the different way of doing water communion, it's already feeling like a lot. And we haven't even started talking about sitting for the postlude yet. Just just checking to see who's awake. And others of you, you probably feel like we're barely scratching the surface of the changes that you're ready for. And I know that all of you want a community that is vibrant and relevant today and for the next generation of Unitarian Universalists. You want a congregation where young families feel welcome, as do elders and parents whose children just left home, and those who live alone, and all those who are coming to seek connection and community. You want them to feel welcome. You want a congregation that finds a way to marginalize its white Anglo roots, make room for the multicultural reality of the world that we live in, and you want a church that keeps pace with the culture but doesn't get swept up in its frenzy. Because spiritual community is one of those places we come to be reminded of the 200-year present. We come and are connected to those who have come before us and those who will come after us. As I start this ministry with you, as we merge our streams and together we face into an uncertain future, full of both possibility for awful devastation and tremendous beauty, let's remember that we can only do so much in a day or a week. I'm mostly saying that to myself here. Thanks. But dream big. Remember, we can only do so much in a day or a week, but dream big about what we can do in 5 years together. May we begin this new year, this new chapter in the life of a congregation, this new shared ministry with that taste of apple and honey in our mouths, the reminder of the sweetness that is present here and